Over the last 10 years, I probably have grown more in depth, not just in knowledge of who God is, but personal experience. And I share that because about 6 years ago, I had an assignment where I had to go and sit in silence and solitude in a place all by myself and just not read, not pray, just sit and listen to what God had to say. And it was a particularly stressful week for me. I wanted to be everywhere but there. And I chose a garden in a house that used to be quite a mansion on a preserve. And it had fallen into disrepair. And I was outside in the garden, and everywhere I looked, there was weeds and broken plants and all that kind of stuff, a lot of gardening, and I loved to garden. And I kept thinking, just be quiet, listen, listen. I'd close my eyes, I would try to hear, nothing. All I could see was a garden that I wanted to work in. And I kept thinking, this 2 hours is gonna take forever. When I heard the Lord say, "What do you see?" And I thought, why are you even asking me? You know that I'm failing right now. I'm not listening to you. I'm wanting to do work. And he said, "No, tell me, in your words, what do you see?" And I said, "I see a beautiful garden that once was, that's full of weeds and brokenness and disrepair, and I want to restore it back to its natural beauty." And God said, "You're just like your father. I have a garden that has fallen into brokenness and disrepair, and I want to restore it. What else do you see? What else do you love to do?" And I said, "I love to feed my family. I love to cook meals and have everybody laugh around the table." And he goes, "Ah, you're just like your father." And that went on, and I thought it was like 15 minutes, and I realized that had gone on for at least an hour. And every time I would share something about God, he would say, "You're just like your father." And I've not been the same since that conversation. I see God in a whole new light. And I want what God wants. And I believe he wants to see his church rise and shine.
Yeah, you can clap for that story. I've been sitting on that one all week. Many of you don't know Kay, but she's one of the pastors in our family of churches that we call our denomination, Evangelical Friends Church Southwest. And she is a woman of prayer, and so I've always been grateful for her friendship and for her insight on things. And our denomination is full of people like this, people who are interested in God's Spirit and what God's Spirit is doing and how we can be a part of it. And so that's why this series in Momentum has been so fun for us, because we've been able to dive right into the kinds of things that God is doing through the whole church, and the kinds of things that our family of churches in particular really want to focus on. And so I kind of want you to hold that story of the garden a little bit. We are going to come back to it because I think it paints a picture for what we want to talk about today. Last week, Heidi helped us understand the idea of community, and particularly what Christian community looks like. So Christians aren't the only people who have the corner market on community. There's a lot of different kinds of community out there. But Christian community has a couple specific characteristics that we kind of have to pay attention to. And she ran us through three, but if you were here last week, you know that the third one she went through really fast, and that's because we're kind of jumping off of that point today. See, one of the markers of Christian community is that we are a community with a mission. We are a community with a mission. We have a purpose. There's something that we're actually trying to do together. And we have to get this mission right. So several years ago, there was a now former executive of Yahoo, and he wrote what was known as the Peanut Butter Manifesto. It wasn't supposed to be released, but it got leaked. And so basically, here's what he was concerned about. Yahoo had become this giant company, at one point in time valued at $125 billion. But if you know anything about technology, you know that it's always changing. And Yahoo figured this out. They knew that everything was changing, and they said, "We want to be on the forefront of everything. Wherever technology is going, we want to be there." And so they started spreading out their resources so that they could jump in on every new development that there was to be had in the technological world. And so this executive wrote this Peanut Butter Manifesto saying this, "I'm concerned about the direction of our company. It seems like we are spreading peanut butter on a sandwich, creating this thin layer of resources over a multitude of topics, but no depth in any one of them. And someday, that's going to undo us." And he was right. Yahoo ultimately sold to Verizon in 2016 for $5 billion. Still more money I have than my, you know, than in my back pocket. But still, like, $125 billion to $5 billion because we had spread our resources over so many different things to focus on. We didn't have depth in any one of them. And that is why the church's mission is so significant. We have one thing to do, one thing to do right. And when we get this, we find that the depth follows. Our mission, of course, is what Kate talked about. It's to tend to the garden. It's to do what God has placed on our hearts, to go out into this broken world and bring restoration and renewal. That's our mission. William Temple put it this way. He said, "The church is the only society that exists for the benefit of those who are not its members." Today I'm going to do probably three different side notes, and so I'm going to side note this for 1 second. So hold the main train of thought here. I do want to address this. Sometimes in church, one of the things that we focus on a lot is ourselves. And you know what? There's actually a biblical basis for that, right? We need to be able to care for each other. This is what Jesus said, right? "The world will know that you are my disciples by how you love one another." And so if we are not loving each other well, then we're not living up to the biblical commands. But this is the funny thing about that. Jesus wanted the world to know that we were his disciples. And this was the marker, that we love each other well. And so when we love each other, we do it because God has transformed our hearts, but it's still with the mission in mind, that the world may know that we are followers of Christ, and that they too can experience the restoration that comes from a relationship with Jesus. So yes, we should rightly be with each other in the hardest moments. One of my roles here is to walk with people during seasons of grief, and right now there's just a lot of that. Some of you are aware, we've lost a lot of people in our church in just a few short weeks. And that kind of stuff can weigh heavy on our heart. But you know what I love about this church? Is that when those things happen, people respond. And so many of you have so faithfully stepped into the grief of others, even just in the last few months. And it's been my honor to see that. And here's what I think is going to happen. When the world sees how Christians love each other, they're going to understand the mission better. That we're demonstrating the love of God and trying to recreate, restore, renew this garden that God is planting. So that's my side note. But ultimately, what we're going to talk about today is the idea of outreach, and this is what William Temple is speaking to. Our mission as the church is to go out into the world and proclaim that Jesus Christ has conquered death, and that every person could be renewed by a relationship with God. It's an incredible message. It's an incredible mission, and we get to be a part of it. And so to talk about this idea today, talk about going out into the world, outreach as we call it, we're going to use Acts chapter 3, so you can go ahead and turn there in your Bibles. It'll also be on the screens as we go. Acts chapter 3. So here's what's happening, right? This is just after some of the stuff Heidi talked about last week. In Acts chapter 2, the last part of it, it was talking about how these Christians were meeting together. They were loving each other well. They were sharing what they had with each other when needs arose. They were making time for each other. It was an incredible community. And now, Peter and John are going to continue the mission. And they're going to go back to a place that for some of us actually may seem just a little bit odd that this is where they're heading to. So Acts chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. "One day, Peter and John were going up to the temple at the time of prayer. At 3 in the afternoon, now a man who was lame from birth was being carried to the temple gate called Beautiful, where he was put every day to beg from those going into the temple courts." All right. He can't go in the temple courts, this lame man. He's not permitted. There's certain barriers. See, if you were someone who had a physical handicap of some sort, the assumption in that day was that it was the result of some sort of sin, which is really funny. You go back in the Old Testament, you read the book of Job, like all throughout the Bible basically says that like bad things happen even to good people and we don't always know why. But in that day, still, they believed that if something bad had happened to you, it is the result of your sin. In fact, in John chapter 9, it's really fun to look at John chapter 9 in this story. The disciples, they're hanging out with Jesus, and they come across this blind man. And the disciples ask the question, "Teacher, is it this man, or is it this man's parents that caused him to be born blind? Was it sin that he was going to commit, or sin already committed in his family that resulted in his blindness?" And Jesus responded, "It wasn't sin. This man was blind because, well, God's going to do an amazing work through him. And Jesus would go on to heal the blind man. Fast forward all these many years later, Peter and John, two of his disciples who would have been there that day, asking Jesus about the blind man. They see this lame man and they know now. They know that just because you have an affliction, it doesn't mean that God has turned his back on you. They see this as a valuable person, someone who needs the redemption of God in their life. So they're going to the temple. They're going to the temple because here's a place where they can pray to God and they can begin to talk to others about Jesus. For them, there wasn't any difference between the God that they had always known, the God of the Jewish religion, and the God of Jesus. They were the same. The only difference was, of course, that Jesus was the fulfillment of everything that God had promised. And we were never going to fully know this God unless we had a relationship with Jesus. But still, it was the same God. And they found that in the temple, they had the ability to, of course, worship this God with so many other people. But they also had the ability to find those who most wanted to have a relationship with him and say, you're missing a really important piece. So the temple was a place that Peter and John would go to often. And as they went in this particular day, they stopped. They didn't actually go all the way to their mission of praying at that point. They saw this man here, this lame man. A man who had been ostracized from his community, forbidden from going far into the temple, and they knew there was an opportunity. Verse 3. When he saw Peter, the lame man, when he saw Peter and John about to enter, he asked them for money. Peter looked straight at him, as did John. Then Peter said, "Look at us." So the man gave them his attention, expecting to get something from them. Which makes sense. I mean, this is something that would have to happen from time to time. It's a lame man with no means to support himself. He had to depend on the generosity of strangers. Most of the time, I doubt he would make eye contact with them. But every once in a while, someone would give him something. And now Peter is demanding this man's attention. And he's hoping, of course, for money. That's the outcome that he's hoping for. Anything shy of money would be a little bit of a disappointment in his mind, right? Because that's how he would get through the day. That's how he would make it to tomorrow, is a couple coins in his bowl, hoping that Peter would respond. But I think what most of us know just intuitively is that money really only delays things. It doesn't solve very many things in our world. And this man needed something much more permanent. So this is Peter's response. Then Peter said, "Silver or gold I do not have, but what I do have I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk." And it goes on to say, taking him by the right hand, he helped him up, and instantly the man's feet and ankles became strong. He jumped to his feet and began to walk. Then he went with them into the temple courts, which he couldn't do before, walking and jumping and praising God. He was hoping for money. What he got was something infinitely better. He got his legs, for sure. It says he's like jumped up from his seating position. I'm not sure I could do that, you know? Jumps up. And he's jumping around because he's got his legs for the first time. It reminds me of the first time I remember learning to ride a bicycle. I was trying for many days to figure it out. I just couldn't seem to do it. And then one day, my dad drove us over to a little parking lot, and I just jumped on the bike, and I just started going. And I just wanted to go in circles all day long, having learned how to ride this bicycle. This is a man who found his legs for the first time. He just can't stop walking and jumping. He'd been given a gift beyond anything he could possibly have hoped to receive. And it wasn't simply that he got his legs back. He was part of the community again. He had the ability to now actually work for a living, to provide for himself, to be with people, to not be seen as someone who is so steeped in sin he wasn't worthy of love. Well, that's different. And Peter and John, they'd given him that, at least as far as he understood. But now, there was an opportunity. Verse 9. When all the people saw him walking and praising God, they recognized him as the same man who used to sit begging at the temple gate called Beautiful, and they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. Here's this man. They know his story. They've seen his face, and here he is jumping around. They are amazed at what's going on. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter for you, but this is what had happened. By performing this miracle, Peter and John now have an opportunity to talk about Jesus. That's mostly the rest of the chapter. They're going to tell those onlookers, the people who were astonished, why they did what they did, and more specifically, how they did it. Because it wasn't about Peter and John, it was never about them. It was always about Jesus. And much like the blind man from the book of John, chapter 9, this man's illness gave space for God to do something incredible. And now Peter and John got to tell all the people who saw this, and the man himself, the real reason he was healed. Because Jesus loved him. And I would love to actually unpack the rest of the chapter. It's fascinating to see how they go about this, but we just don't have time. There's a bunch of things from the story that I think we need to learn. It's there that I want to focus. Because Peter and John had some very specific ideas about their mission. Some things that they knew they had to do in order to obey Jesus when he said, go out into all the world, make disciples of every nation, all peoples. They knew that there were some things they had to do. And so we're going to look at three different ideas here that I want us to walk away with this morning. And the first is this. We actually have to be aware of the people who are near you. And this one's a little bit tricky for us. And this is part of why this layman's story is so interesting. And there's people who passed him all day long. They knew his face, but they rarely interacted with him. Partly because he wanted something from them. He wanted money. But also because this man was seen as a sinner who was outside of society. He wasn't seen as important. And if you don't give someone any sort of importance, you usually don't invest very much time in them. But this is what Peter and John knew. They knew that every person needed to have a relationship with God. That every person needed to hear about this Jesus who had transformed their life. There wasn't a flower that wasn't worth tending to. They were all beautiful before God. And they stopped and made time to show up. The funny thing about this is that I like to think in my life that I don't do that to people, right? I don't treat people as less than. I don't treat people as unimportant. And my theological outlook, my practical outlook, of course, is that, yeah, all people are equal. There isn't someone I would meet who I would overtly say, you are not worthy of God's love. It's just, when I'm actually out in the world, I kind of have to pick and choose a little bit, you know? We can't necessarily stop and make friends with every person. We're going to talk about this in a little while. But in the process, I tend to stop viewing people as people. Usually, it's the people who are between me and something I want. And so something like if I'm trying to get a cup of coffee at Starbucks, between me and the cup of coffee, of course, is a barista, someone who's supposed to actually help serve that coffee. Or if I need to return something at Target, between me and that return is, of course, the person who's working in customer services. And in these moments, most days, I'm not thinking of these people as people. They're between me and the thing that I want. Now, it doesn't mean I'm unfriendly. I could be friendly. I could put on a friendly face like the best of you all, I assure you. But I'm not consciously thinking about their humanity or, of course, their need for God in their life. What I'm focused on is my return or my Starbucks order, of course. And you know, this day, Peter and John, they could have been so focused on what was a very noble cause. They were supposed to be praying at the temple. They were supposed to be going into the temple. I mean, should we be distracted from prayer? It was an important thing. But they saw this man, they saw someone who needed God's love, and they said, this now is our priority. It matters more than my Starbucks drink or my return at Target. And it changed everything for this man and the people who observed it. Because they were aware. But this applies to all different aspects of our life. I mean, have you ever taken inventory? Do you know all the neighbors that you live with? Do you know the people that are on your child's sports teams? Do we know the people where we work? Our classmates? Are there some we choose to avoid? These are all people that are near us. I like to think of it this way. We need to pay attention to the people who are within arm's reach. They passed by this man, they could have reached out and touched him. Are there people in our lives that we could physically reach out and touch that we've simply ignored? And if we have, now we've missed an opportunity, perhaps, to build a relationship, to build a friendship, and at some point, maybe, point someone to the love that God has for them. But Peter and John, they didn't miss that opportunity. All right, second thing, and this is important because sometimes in church circles we can forget this part, and this is this. Physical needs are actually important. Peter and John had no problem dealing with this man's physical needs before they talked about the spiritual. That wasn't their concern. I mean, you can imagine something like this, where Peter and John could look at this man, and of course they said, we don't have any money, but they could also think to themselves, you don't really even need to walk either. All you need is Jesus, and then turn and walk away, you know? Oh, but the problem is sometimes we do that. Oh, it's a challenge, because we know we can't meet every need that's out there, and sometimes it's an inconvenience for us, and so we can bless someone and say, I hope you find Jesus, and walk the other way. In the book of James, chapter 2, verse 16, this is a paraphrase of essentially the situation that James is setting up. He's setting up the situation where essentially you're talking to someone and you know that they have a need, that they don't have a cloak and they're going to be cold out in the streets, or they're hungry and you're not feeding them. And then you say to them, go in peace and stay warm and be well fed, and they'll walk away. How useless is that when we're not stepping into the situation and finding a way to actually keep them warm and well-fed, which leads James to conclude in the next verse, of course, that faith without works is dead. It doesn't mean that we have a work salvation by any means. That's a tangent, a side tangent I'm not going to take today. But we are called to back up the faith that we have with real loving action toward people, to actually meet their needs when we're able, or if possible, at least to help give them space where their needs can be met. Now, we can't heal everybody like Peter and John did. God does some amazing things, and sometimes there's a physical healing there. But what we can do, oftentimes, is bring people into the temple courts, so to speak. Take people to the places where things can actually happen, where they could be restored to their community, where they could be given something of eternal consequence and lasting consequence in their communities. And it's these kinds of things that really do have an impact in the world around us. And there's all sorts of examples of this, of course. Around here we have a food pantry. And we can meet the need in the moment, but I also know that these are people who are consistently helping families as they're going through really difficult seasons in their life on a daily basis. And we could be there for a neighbor. If a neighbor gets sick and they have some needs, we can be there to support those needs. If you have a classmate or someone at work who has something come up in their life and there's a way that we could step in, that's where we're called to meet the physical needs. And it's all part of what Jesus asked us to do, to step in and love people well. My second side note for the morning, our missionaries do this really well. I'm not actually going to focus on missionaries this morning because actually next week, Steve Gamer and Brad Hazlett, if you know them, they work with partners, they're going to come and share with us. And these are people who, if you have not heard from them before, they get this idea of meeting physical needs really well. And they do so in some of the hardest places in the world. And our missionaries do this. They go to some of the hardest places in the world, and they meet people's physical and relational needs, the things they actually need there. And it's incredible to see. So I invite you to come back next week and hear that. For us, we have so many people right around us who do have real needs. It can be weird in your Belinda sometimes. You know, not everyone necessarily is about to go hungry, at least that we can see. But we do know that we have a huge problem with loneliness. We talked about that last week. And there might be something we can do there. And sometimes people's needs just aren't as apparent, but when we step into relationship with them, we find out about the grief that they're experiencing or the difficulties that they're having that they're just not sharing with anyone else, and now we can step in and be a real presence to them. This stuff does matter. And so then the third thing that Peter and John focused on, and of course they hit this, is that we have to be prepared to answer the why. We have to be ready to answer the why. Here's what I mean. When Peter and John healed the lame man, they didn't do it because they thought they were awesome. It was something that they probably could have claimed at that moment. They could have made themselves heroes if they wanted to be, but they always knew that this wasn't about them. In fact, putting the attention on Peter and John would have sabotaged the whole mission. That's not the point. The reason why they healed this man, the reason why he was jumping up and down inside the temple courts, was because of Jesus. And we can't neglect the spiritual realities in our world that everyone needs to know about. So sometimes we can go the other way, right? Sometimes we could jump to the spiritual needs too fast, and that's where we miss actually addressing people's real physical needs. But we can also address people's physical needs and then kind of get nervous about sharing the reason why. Never putting it out there that we're doing this because of a God who transformed our lives, and in return, we want to transform the lives of others. So we need to be prepared then to explain why it is we do what we do. When we show love to people, we do it because God loved us. This, by the way, I hope takes off some of the pressure about this whole idea of sharing your faith. Sometimes we feel like that's like a really big, scary thing. Like we're supposed to have this like two-page spiel memorized, right? And say, okay, everyone, I want you to sit down, listen to me. Do you know where you're going tonight if you die? You know, like that kind of a thing. When we do things that reflect the kingdom of God, people are going to notice that. And either implicitly or explicitly, they're going to want to know why. And when we have a relationship with them, we have some space to step into that conversation. That was my last side note for the morning. I want to talk about this for a minute, because here's the problem that I think we have sometimes, is that when we talk about sharing our faith with other people, it can sound almost manipulative. In our culture, it starts from this place of sounding manipulative. Just before we had Emma, Kristen and I were at Home Goods. I didn't even know that Home Goods was a store until I met Kristen, but she showed me the light. So we're at Home Goods. This is as we're trying to do a home renovation, so we actually do have some things we need to acquire. We're in the kitchen section in this particular situation. We're trying to find things that will work well with our redone kitchen. So as we're there, we meet this other young couple who are also sorting through things. And they make eye contact with us, and Kristen picks up something that we may or may not use in the home. She's evaluating it. And the girl looks over to her and says, "Oh, that looks beautiful. That's awesome." It's like, well, thank you for validating my not yet decided purchase. And then she goes on to make some more conversation. "Oh yeah, you know, we're just trying to figure out life ourselves. We're trying to figure out like what kinds of things will look good in our little apartment and stuff like that. But we have some other plans for other things that we're trying to do." And so then the guy comes over and he starts to talk. So of course I go over, so the four of us are sitting there in the kitchen aisle, this really narrow kitchen aisle, talking to each other, people I don't know from anything, learn their names, and they continue then to just ask about our lives. Like, this is really cool. Who just like shows up and asks about your life, right? And so they want to know all about our renovation plans and our lives and what we're doing. Like, they are super interested in Kristen and I. And Kristen immediately knew something was wrong. No one does this, right? And so here they are, we're talking, and they're asking a little bit about what we do, and they seem to get a little bit of a furrowed brow. They talk a little bit about what they do, because we'd ask them, of course, like, "So what do you do?" And well, they're self-employed, and they're working to realize their dreams of being able to work from home and retire at an early age, and they have this system in place to make that happen. And you know what? If we wanted it, we could be involved in it and work under them. The conversation ended shortly after that. We never saw them again. Right, because here's the thing, that relationship was built on a pretense. They wanted something from us. They wanted us to join them in their little enterprise. And we, at least Kristen anyway, quickly figured that out. And so it kind of sabotaged the whole thing. Like, we knew that everything they had said before that moment was actually disingenuous. They didn't actually care about our home renovation, believe it or not. Oh, man. All right. And this is how it can sometimes feel, of course, if we're talking to people about our faith. We feel like it's possible that we're just kind of imposing on someone, that we have an agenda. And people know if you're coming to them with an agenda. And usually it doesn't bode well by the end of it. It feels awkward. It almost feels like you're trying to take advantage of them in some way. Now, we were talking about this in the preaching team a little bit, trying to figure out how, you know, when we share our faith, it's different than that. Because, of course, we're not actually trying to get anything from anyone. What we actually want is something for them. And so we were thinking maybe one way that we could say it is we want something for other people rather than something from them. But then I was watching the second Fantastic Beasts movie yesterday, and that's exactly what Grindelwald said to someone he was trying to take advantage of. "I want something for you, not something from you." It's hard because if you don't know somebody, no matter what they say, no matter how good it sounds, it seems manipulative. It seems like they're trying to get something from you, even if they act like your friend or seem like they have your best interests in mind. And I say all this as a side note, a really long one, because this is inevitable. When we're talking to people about what God has done in our lives, and we're talking to people who don't know us, our motivations will always be suspect. Our culture is just suspicious of Christians and what they have to say and what they believe and what they're doing. They sometimes feel like they're being taken advantage of or manipulated. And there's not much you can do about that if you're going into a conversation cold turkey. They don't know you. They don't know anything about you. But imagine the difference if you're having this conversation with a neighbor that you've invested in, with another parent on your child's sports team, with someone you've been working next to for 5 years and you care about their life. Well, at this point, you can bring up what you believe and why you believe it, and there's no question about your motives behind it. They aren't some project to you. They're someone you've already cared about and invested in. And that's why when we talk about outreach, sometimes there might be situations where you can have a conversation with a complete stranger about faith, and I've had them, and they can be amazing, but many times, the place to start is with the people who are already around you, those people within arm's reach that you already have a relationship with. And people that I've already had a relationship with, I have never in my life experienced the end of that relationship just because I talked about what I believed in. I haven't yet. Maybe some of you have. But in my experience, if I already have that relationship, I can talk about why I believe what I believe. I can talk about why I think this Jesus guy is so important. And they might disagree with me, and they may never come around to it, but they don't feel like I'm taking advantage of them. In fact, I oftentimes get this comment, "You're not like any Christian I've ever met before." But then I've talked to many of you who said you've had conversations with someone who said, "You're not like any Christian I've ever met before," which leads me to wonder, who are these Christians that you've met before? I think the Christians they met before are an idea that we want something from people, but that's not what we want. What we want is to restore the garden. See, for those of us in this room who've had a radical encounter with Jesus before, and our hearts have been changed and our life is different, we want to see that beauty go out beyond us. And I don't get anything from anybody if they decide to follow Jesus. But the garden's made a little more beautiful. And that flower is restored. And I get to be on that mission with God. See, God's love is so powerful, so profound, that he did all the hard work to bring beauty from the ashes, to make something new. And I want to be in on it. And that's why we do outreach. Around here, I've been talking to some people who have become more aware of their stories, right? In Rooted, for instance, we know that when we talk about some of our stories, you get to hear a little bit about the brokenness that existed in people's lives, and you get to see the ways in which God is making something new out of that brokenness, and it is beautiful. I do have to admit, the garden metaphor is a little bit odd for me because I don't have a green thumb at all. If I plant something, it will die. So for me, like, it just doesn't quite fit. If I'm restoring something, I'm thinking more of like a computer that got a virus on it or something like that, where I'm trying to restore the operator. That's how my mind works, right? Problem for me, though, is that if I'm restoring a computer, I'm actually trying to get it to go back to an old way of being. I'm trying to reverse the clock to the way something was. But the reason why the garden picture is so fascinating is because, yes, we're trying to make something new. We're trying to bring back beauty, but we're bringing back beauty from new creations that are stepping into the garden. I was talking with David and Lisa Hill, and some of you know their story. They've shared it in this context. They had a lot of brokenness in their life and in their marriage, and God met them there. And they intentionally try to avoid the word restored because they don't want to go back to the way they were before. They want to be something new. They want to be recreated. And so out of their story, out of the brokenness that was there, those two, along with many of you who have partnered with them, have set up a lot of ministries that are helping to restore and renew people who've experienced brokenness in their life. We call these ministries Freed, and that's for anyone who has anything in their life that's keeping them from the relationship with Jesus that they want. But also some new ones, a single and parenting group, a grief share group, a divorce group. People who have experienced some brokenness in their life, but God wants to do something new in them. And it's incredible to see what happens when God does that. And when God takes a story where there's brokenness, those same people who experience that renewal, those are usually the ones most passionate about going out into the garden and replanting. Because they know what it's like to have their life transformed. Around here, there's a bunch of things that we try to do as a church that focus on these kinds of things. We already talked about the food pantry, of course, and we have a ministry to foster care students who are, of course, in a difficult situation, and to international students who come from all different contexts all around the world. We do things to try and reach out to our community and meet needs that are actually there. In the spring, we'll do Love Placentia again, and that's an emphasis that goes beyond even us into other churches. But more immediately, we have things like Canning Hunger and Boxes of Love, which you'll hear about soon, opportunities to feed the people right around you, opportunities to even get your neighbors involved in the action. And we do this because we see this garden out there like Kay talked about, and we want to see it renewed. We want to see God do something fantastic there. And he tends to show up. And that's why we do this. I want to invite the praise band back up because we're gonna finish with a song together. We've talked about these people who are within arm's reach, right? They tend to be our coworkers, our neighbors, our classmates, the people that we see all the time. And I know, and I do not want to put any guilt on you. I know that you cannot reach every single one of these people. You can't. This was never meant to be a solo project. That's why we have a church, a body of believers, why we do it together. But here's something I actually learned from a preacher. His name's Andy Stanley. I've kind of taken this quote, and I love it. He said, "Do for one what you wish you can do for all." We can't necessarily step into every person's life, but I assure you that the number of people that you can make a difference in their life is greater than zero. There's at least one, maybe two, maybe more, that God might put across your path this week where you can make a difference in their life, where you can help to restore and renew the garden that's in their heart. Will you take advantage of that opportunity to make a reach, to let them know about the God who loves them so much that he gave up everything for them? God, today I pray that as we go from this place, we would be passionate about reaching the world, not because we're going to get anything from it, God, but because we see this garden, we see your heart, and we want to follow your heart. We want to renew this garden with you, and you have invited us to do that. So God, take us, use us, stir in us this passion to reach out to this broken world and show them your love. In your name we pray.